History always produces sparks, but some sparks flare and then vanish, while others touch off firestorms out of any proportion to the sparks themselves. History always produces good and bad ideas. Some quickly dissipate, while others become great inspirations or horrible scourges. The history of American reactions to foreign provocations is filled with such contrasts. Compare, for example, America's involvement in World War I and World War II. Both wars were preceded by aggressive foreign acts, the sinking of the Lusitania, the air attack on Pearl Harbor. In one case, Congress waited 2 years and patiently endured further provocations before declaring war amid significant political opposition. In the other case, it declared war the next day, and did so with only a single dissenting vote. In one case, the war helped inflame divisive issues like prohibition, labor violence, and sedition trials. In the other, the nation mobilized with no distractions. Both wars ended in total victory. In one case, soldiers came home to moral nagging and vice squads. In the other, to ticker tape parades. Both wars strengthened America's influence overseas. In one case, that influence was quickly squandered. In the other, it was consolidated over the next 2 decades. During a fourth turning, generational forces tend to funnel exogenous events towards a concerted national response. When Hitler and Tojo launched their global aggressions, America was poised for decisive action. With prophets in power and heroes coming of age, the archetypal order givers were in charge and the archetypal order takers were on the battlefield. The result was maximum cooperation between generations. Elder prophet leaders do not back down from confrontation. Indeed, Sam Adams, John Brown, and FDR have all been plausibly accused of helping to stage a crisis for the express purpose of galvanizing younger people. Halfway across the saeculum, no war can escape the cross-currents of a youth-fired awakening. During the Vietnam War, the archetypal order-takers were old, the order-givers young. Young prophets challenged the moral emptiness of the institutions directing them. Meanwhile, elder heroes did everything they could to preempt the need for sacrifice, if necessary by means of sheer affluence and technology. The result was maximum convulsion between generations. During the late 1960s, both generations were ill at ease in their war-waging roles, each displeasing the other with its behavior. Every major war in Anglo-American history has been shaped by the turning during which it arose. Does the rhythm of the saeculum make a war cycle unavoidable? No one knows. An awakening does not require a war, nor, perhaps, does a crisis, even though every fourth turning since the 15th century has culminated in total war. History teaches only that whatever wars do happen always reflect the mood of the current turning. Wars in a fourth turning find the broadest possible definition and are fought to unambiguous outcomes. Since the saeculum is at work to some degree throughout the modern world, however, it may well say something about when America is likely to encounter what sort of allies or adversaries abroad. Soon after the American Revolution, a fledgling U.S. republic was probably fortunate that the old world was entirely absorbed in its own crisis, its own age of revolution. The same could be said of the 1860s. While America fought the Civil War, Europe and Japan were busy with their own wars of nation-building. VE Day, VJ Day, and the creation of the Iron Curtain were profound fourth-turning events throughout most of the world. As such, the saeculum's timing among different societies probably became better synchronized after World War II than ever before in modern history. Today's archetypal constellations all around the world show striking similarities. At the top are the elders whom everyone still associates with civic trust and big institutions, and who have recently passed from power amid fears that their strong, if bullying, hand on the national tiller cannot be replaced. Peers of America's GI generation, they are known as the generation of the Long March, Deng Xiaoping, of the Blitz, Margaret Thatcher, of the Resistance, François Mitterrand, Giulio Andreotti, and of the Patriotic War, Leonid Brezhnev, Yuri Andropov. Taking their place as leaders is a grown-up air raid generation of war children, the likes of Boris Yeltsin, Helmut Kohl, Jacques Chirac, Jean Chrétien, and Romano Prodi. Postmodern experts who tout glasnost, diplomacy, communication, and bureaucracy while all the old alliances meander and splinter. Behind them comes the global generation that came of age amid youth riots, the invasion of Prague, Euro-terrorism, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. In Europe, this is the 50-ish generation of 1968. Alexander Lebed, Lech Walesa, Gerry Adams, Prince Charles. In Israel, this is the post-Exodus generation of Benjamin Netanyahu. Anti-establishment, values-obsessed, resistant to Western pop culture, and drawn to angry partisans, the boomers' foreign counterparts have thus far been very slow coming to power. Their era of leadership still lies mostly ahead. As for today's youthful 90s generation, in France the BOF generation, as in Who Cares, the global media are dishing out the following descriptors: fun-loving and rootless, environmentalist and entrepreneurial, pragmatic and market-oriented, globalist economically yet xenophobic socially, and thus far profoundly uninterested in politics. From Reagan's special friendship with Thatcher to undergrad surfing the web in Seattle and Minsk, the cross-national affinity between today's generations probably ensures that Americans of leadership age will continue to encounter similar temperaments abroad for the next two or three decades at least. This may accentuate the rhythms of the saeculum and reinforce its quaternal timing, perhaps with stormier crises followed by higher highs. Then again, it may do nothing of the sort. No one knows. The saeculum is not an entirely stable social dynamic, and for a very simple reason. Total stability is beyond the reach of any human system. Now let's meet the Gray Champion, a pivotal figure in the fourth turning scenario. One afternoon in April 1689, as the American colonies boiled with rumors that King James II was about to strip them of their liberties, the king's hand-picked governor of New England, Sir Edmund Andros, marched his troops menacingly through Boston. His purpose was to crush any thought of colonial self-rule. To everyone present, the future looked grim. Just at that moment, seemingly from nowhere, there appeared on the streets the figure of an ancient man, with the eye, the face, the attitude of command. His manner, combining the leader and the saint, the old man planted himself directly in the path of the approaching British soldiers and demanded that they stop. The solemn yet warlike peal of that voice, fit either to rule a host in the battlefield or be raised to God in prayer, were irresistible. At the old man's word and outstretched arm, the roll of the drum was hushed at once, and the advancing line stood still. Inspired by this single act of defiance, the people of Boston roused their courage and acted. Within the day, Andros was deposed and jailed, the liberty of Boston saved, and the corner turned on the colonial glorious revolution. "Who was this Gray Champion?" asked Nathaniel Hawthorne near the end of this story in his Twice-Told Tales. No one knew, except that he had once been among the fire-hearted young Puritans who had first settled New England more than half a century earlier. Later that evening, just before the old priest-warrior disappeared, the townspeople saw him embracing the 85-year-old Simon Bradstreet, a kindred spirit and one of the few original Puritans still alive. Would the Gray Champion ever return? "I have heard," added Hawthorne, "that whenever the descendants of the Puritans are to show the spirit of their sires, the old man appears again." Posterity had to wait a while before seeing him again, the length of another long human life, in fact. "When 80 years had passed," wrote Hawthorne, "the Gray Champion reappeared. The occasion was the revolutionary summer of 1775, when America's elders once again appealed to God, summoned the young to battle, and dared the hated enemy to fire. When our fathers were toiling at the breastwork on Bunker's Hill," Hawthorne continued, "all through that night the old warrior walked his rounds." This old warrior, this graying peer of Sam Adams, or Ben Franklin, or Samuel Langdon, the Harvard president who preached to the Bunker Hill troops, had belonged to the awakening generation, whose youth had provided the spiritual taproot of the Republic secured in their old age. Hawthorne wrote this stirring legend in 1837, as a young man of 33. The Bunker Hill fathers belonged to his parents' generation, by then well into old age. The nation had new arguments over slavery, and new enemies, Mexico, but no one expected the old people of that era, the worldly likes of John Marshall and John Jacob Astor, to be playing the role of Grey Champion. "Long, long may it be ere he comes again," Hawthorne prophesied. "His hour is one of darkness and adversity and peril. But should domestic tyranny oppress us, or the invader's step pollute our soil, still may the Grey Champion come." Although Hawthorne did not say when this would be, perhaps he should have been able to tell. A quarter century later, his peers, the generation of Abraham Lincoln, would know the answer. We may prefer to see ourselves as masters of nature, controllers of all change and progress, exempt from the seasons of history. Yet the more we balk at seasonality and the more we try to eradicate it, the more menacing we render our view of time and the future. Most of today's Americans grew up in a society whose citizens dreamed of perpetually improving outcomes, better jobs, fatter wallets, stronger government, finer culture, nicer families, smarter kids, all the usual fruits of progress. Today, deep into a third turning, these goals often feel like they are slipping away. Many of us wish we could rewind time, but we know we can't, and we fear for our children and grandchildren. In a sense, Americans resemble a primitive people who, feeling the dry chill of a deepening autumn, grow nostalgic for spring while wondering how, or even if, the moist warmth will ever arrive again. Many Americans wish that, somehow, they could bring back a secular spring now. But seasons don't work that way. As in nature, a secular autumn can be warm or cool, long or short, but the leaves will surely fall. The secular winter can hurry or wait, but history warns that it will surely be upon us. We may not wish the Grey Champion to come again, but come he must, and come he will. The next leg of your journey is part history, part prophecy. It begins with the end of World War II, runs through the present, and extends into the old age of today's young adults. You will relearn recent American history from a seasonal perspective, as the confluence of familiar lives and times. You will learn about the mood shifts that followed the gateway years of the middle 1940s, 1960s, and 1980s. You will reacquaint yourself with today's generations, as archetypes that shift into a new constellation with each new turning. You will learn what this could mean in the next fourth turning. This time, the history lesson will be your own life story. Now let's take a closer look at our most recent first turning, the American High, 1946 to 1964. On VJ Day, August 15, 1945, peace had been declared, but America remained mobilized for total war. The nation had been locked in crisis for as long as anyone could remember, and the landscape looked it. Harbors bristled with warships, highways with convoys, depots with war materiel, bureaucracies with war planners, factories with war workers. Still geared for production, assembly lines were expected to shut down just as millions of veterans came home needing work. A return to pre-war class conflict seemed inevitable. As the war neared its foreseeable triumph, Americans assumed the coming era would resemble the recent past, the hard-bitten 1930s and the cynical 1920s. Fortune magazine feared a resumption of rude pushing ways and ill temper. Many economists saw a new depression ahead. Sumner Schlichter warned of the greatest and swiftest disappearance of markets in all history. A month after VJ Day, Life magazine forecast a sharp decline in the U.S. birth rate. Fearing a thinning population and collapsing economy, the United States government began planning a massive campaign involving some 200 organizations to provide work relief on the scale of the original New Deal. It wasn't necessary. Upbeat America confounded the pessimists. Veterans mustered out without any hint of riot, and the triumphant mood lingered. By June 1946, the nation realized that the post-war mood shift was permanent and massive. "The great American boom is on," Fortune magazine proclaimed, "and there is no measuring it. The old yardsticks won't do. The spectacle is so vast and confusing, it's hard to understand. There's a rich queerness to the U.S. scene in the summer of 1946. Parallels with 1929 or 1939 or any other period break down quickly." Quoting Walt Whitman just after the Civil War, The editors prodded America to open up all your valves and let her go. Swing, whirl with the rest. You will soon get under such momentum you can't stop if you would. The new boom was not just in economic activity, but also in fertility. Babies conceived in the ecstasy of VJ night were born in mid-April 1946, launching a procreative birth bulge that lasted until a tragedy in late 1963 altered the national mood in a different way. Those two markers, VJ Day and the Kennedy assassination, bracket an era variously known as Pax Americana, Good Times, The Best Years, Happy Days, and The American High. Thanks to vintage TV and nostalgia movies, deeply etched memories of the American high are continually recalled decades later. People now in their 40s or older widely remember this as an era when large institutions were regarded as effective, government as powerful, science as benign, schools as good, careers as reliable, families as strong, and crime as under control. Government could afford to do almost anything it wanted while still balancing its budget. From year to year, the middle class grew, and the gap between rich and poor narrowed. Worker productivity and family incomes grew at the fastest pace ever measured, with no end in sight. The planned orderliness of suburbia was the natural lifestyle for an America bent on entering what one contemporary writer called an age of security. With the horrors of Hitler and Stalin fresh in the public mind, the nation's domestic calm was shielded by a vigilant Cold War realism. When World War II ended in 1945, no one dared to predict that no others would follow, explains historian Paul Johnson. There was a general despondent assumption that future conflicts would stretch on endlessly. To guard against this threat, many of the American high's grandest edifices, interstate highways, basic research, student loans, new math and science curricula, were built explicitly in the name of national defense. The new suburbs reflected this preoccupation with security. If consumerism could be standardized, private needs could be met efficiently, saving resources for the big projects needed to ensure the long-term survival of the nation. If the new lifestyle also provided the cultural underpinnings for thrift and teamwork, with everybody pitching in like good neighbors sharing lawnmowers, all the better for America's future. The new ethos drew plenty of criticism for conformity and materialism. The 1954 book, Age of Conformity, defined the American as someone who is satisfied with not less than the best in airplanes and plumbing, but accepts the second rate in politics and culture. The 1956 film, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, satirized citizens so robotic that nobody noticed when they were taken over by aliens. Melvina Reynolds sang of little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Lewis Mumford despaired of the multitude of uniform, unidentifiable houses lined up inflexibly at uniform distances on uniform roads in a treeless command waste inhabited by people of the same class, the same incomes, the same age group, witnessing the same television performances, eating the same tasteless prefabricated foods from the same freezers. Newton Minow assaulted television as a vast wasteland of shallow, albeit wholesome, programming. When Michael Harrington wrote The Other America, his implicit message was that the main, middle-class America may have been doing better than it deserved. The high mindset of optimism and pragmatism included many elements that today's Americans loathe, from racism and sexism to a stifling groupthink and a Philistine culture. Looking back, the mood of the American high strikes many 90s-era Americans as a creaking anachronism. But at the time, it felt extremely modern, a wedding of optimism, technology, and prosperity to a crisp, if unreflective, sense of collective purpose. To understand how and why the American high came to be, you need to picture the generational history of those years. Consider each life cycle transition then occurring. The hard-knocks elder lost, cordoning off the social perimeters to enable the mood to calm. The GIs deriving energy from midlife conformism. The silent becoming adaptable helpmates. And the boomers receiving new indulgences. Seen from a lifestyle perspective, the post-war mood was, in many ways, inevitable. In the years between 1946 and 1963, America succeeded in many areas, such as public cooperation, where we today feel we are failing. So too was it notoriously weak in many areas, such as personal fulfillment, where we today think ourselves doing well. That should come as no surprise. In the middle 1950s, at the peak of the high, America lay at the opposite end of the saeculum from where we are now. Seen in terms of archetypes, highs produce this mood because of the new life cycle phases each archetype is then entering. Nomads into elderhood, heroes into midlife, artists into young adulthood, and prophets into childhood. Consider the four phases and archetypes in turn. As exhausted nomads replace prophets in elderhood, they slow the pace of social change, shunning the old crusades in favor of simplicity and survivalism. Believers in functional social rituals, they become old-fashioned elders who place a high priority on protecting children and safeguarding the society's long-term future. Still stigmatized, they strike other generations as burned out, even reactionary. They claim little for themselves at a time when the public mood is focused less on rewarding the old than investing in the young. As powerful heroes replace nomads in midlife, they establish an upbeat, constructive ethic of social discipline. Their ears ringing with post-crisis accolades, midlife heroes become builders and doers. Confident of their ability to make big institutions work, they energize and rationalize every sphere of life, from science to religion, statecraft to the arts. They expect to propel civilization over an unprecedented threshold of secular progress, toward wealth, happiness, knowledge, and power. As sensitive artists replace heroes in young adulthood, they become sensitive helpmates, lending their expertise and cooperation to an era of growing social calm. They learn to excel at satisfying expectations and playing the helpmate to the hero's grand constructions. As they infuse the culture with new vitality, they probe cautiously for a more inwardly fulfilling role. As prophets replace artists in childhood, they are nurtured with increasing indulgence by optimistic adults in a secure environment. In the orderly post-crisis world, parents can safely devote more time to child-raising and offer new freedoms to a new generation. Nurtured by a well-ordered but spiritually depleted society, children are urged to cultivate strong inner lives. Presumed to have a bright future, children are encouraged to demand much of life. Picture these four archetypes in these life cycle phases layered into a constellation of generations. The sum total of these four archetypal shifts is the shift in public mood from a crisis to a high. Now reflect on the generational history of the most recent first turning, the American high from 1946 through 1964. A turning is, at bottom, a history of what millions of like-aged people do in their daily lives. As you listen to these brief sketches, filter in your own recollections and think about how people you know may have reflected these archetypes. First, let's look at the lost generation who were then entering elderhood. Unprotected by families as children, unrewarded by governments as adults, and criticized by other generations all their lives, the lost grew old with a low collective self-image. Distrustful of government, they played the sap for richer and better-educated young people, and seldom lobbied on their own behalf. Their low self-image also enabled them to do the dirty work that others could not or would not do. The buck stopped with them. As elders, the generation that had electrified America before the crisis calmed America afterwards. Those wild young people who made the 1920s roar either burned out entirely or matured into old-fashioned cautionaries, the likes of Virgil Thompson or Norman Rockwell, 30 years later. By the protective cordon of their stewardship, they made possible the modernizing optimism of their juniors. But it was never an optimism they shared. According to Paul Tillich, our generation has seen the horrors latent in man's being rise to the surface and erupt. In their view, the post-war world remained dangerous. By the mid-60s, gerontologists came to believe that thrift, self-reliance, cynicism, conservatism, and Republican voting habits were permanent aspects of the aging process in America. How times change. Next, let's look at the GIs entering midlife. During their childhood, GIs had been fussed over by protective parents determined to raise up kids as good as the lost generation had been bad. Youth clubs, vitamins, safe playgrounds, pasteurized milk, child labor laws, even prohibition. These all were efforts to keep these kids away from the danger and decadence of the prior generation. GIs responded by growing up as the straight-arrow achievers that adults had been praying for, as the first Boy Scouts, the first Miss Americas, and, with Charles Lindbergh in 1927, the first All-American heroes. By the mid-1920s, cynicism and individualism were out on college campuses. Optimism and cooperation were in. Their unfaltering attitude served them well after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Less than 4 years after suddenly becoming the most uniformed generation in U.S. history, they returned as victors. Of the 97% of GI men who came home without serious injury, the war provided a generational slingshot, converting a reputation for youthful virtue into one of midlife power. Described by historian Joseph Goulden as a generation content to put its trust in government and authority, rising GI leaders saw more chaos than opportunity in the creative destruction of the marketplace. As their economists strove to flatten the business cycle, their legislators expanded social insurance to minimize family risks and regulatory agencies to minimize business risks. The federal government showered benefits on the middle class and middle-aged, as the post-war GI Bill became America's largest ever intergenerational transfer program to people entering midlife. What the GI Bill fostered was not just the suburb, but what the organization man author William White called the suburban GI social ethic. Much praised in its own time, but much criticized later, that ethic embraced cooperation, community involvement, friendliness, and a sharp delineation between the correct roles for men and women. Like Sloane Wilson's hero in Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, the ideal male was a hard striver, the ideal female, a devoted nurturer. Middle-aged blacks were presumed to share the majoritarian culture, and the goals of the early civil rights movement reflected this presumption. As the GI media bleached out African-American rhythms and dressed black stars in white shirts and ties, GI business came to realize that integration was more economically efficient than segregation. In time, this attitude would lead GI Congresses to enact legislation that had nothing to do with affirmative action or cultural pluralism, but followed from the logic of equal opportunity. In 1960, with an all-GI presidential race, this robust generation sought to bring to national leadership the same energy it had already brought to the family, economy, and culture. In his inaugural, President Kennedy proclaimed that the torch has been passed to a new generation born in this century. Having campaigned on the slogan, "Let's get this country moving again," he committed his peers to bear any burden, pay any price, to bring vigor and prestige back into civic life. In this new era of the imperial presidency, there would be no limit to how far and how fast the nation could rise. In the early 1960s, Richard Rovere christened another expression to describe the new power of midlife GIs: the establishment. At the time, those two words carried a proud, totally positive connotation. The early 1960s was a time when public power was a public good. Next, let's look at the silent generation entering young adulthood. In the first years of the high, silent collegians found themselves surrounded by returning GI vets who got the best grades and job offers, and who tolerated no lip from their juniors. In 1949, Fortune chastised the first mostly silent college class for taking no chances and displaying a gray flannel mentality. According to surveys, most of them wanted to work for big organizations. Almost none wanted to start their own businesses. As historian William Manchester quipped, "Never had American youth been so withdrawn, cautious, unimaginative, indifferent, unadventurous, and silent." The major challenge facing silent teens was to emulate older GIs. The typical date and mate path was the tender trap: pairing off quickly, tying the knot after graduation, moving to the suburbs, and then blending in among GI neighbors. Applying a similar loyalism to the work world, Silent Men hastened to seal lifetime deals with big employers. Millions of Silent Men joined the rat race, and it paid off big. By age 20, most had exceeded their parents' lifetime education. By 25, their parents' housing. By 30, their incomes. From age 20 to 40, no other American generation has attained such a steep rise in real per capita income and per household wealth. Yet to the Silent's frustration, the high lent them no real coming-of-age challenge, and they were not of a temperament to invent a challenge for themselves. After they watched the careers of pre-war leftists get chewed up in the McCarthy hearings, they avoided the unorthodox and safeguarded their permanent records. The military draft system channeled them into socially useful directions, pressuring young men with larger draft calls, as a percentage of the eligible pool, than boomers would face at the peak of the Vietnam War. Yet hardly anybody protested. The Silent instead displayed what Stephen Rosenfeld remembers as a respect for authority and a toleration for discipline that came to look outlandish. As the high wore on, many young graduates decided to lend a badly needed measure of humanity, sensitivity, and beauty to a new social order that struck them as a little too rigid and geometric. They surged into expert helping careers, medicine, ministry, law, teaching, social work, government, producing this century's biggest one-generation leap in the share of all workers belonging to a credentialed profession. The Silent excelled at arts and letters, infusing subversive life and feeling into every genre they touched. Once Elvis Presley was deemed acceptable by G.I. Minister of Culture Ed Sullivan, rock and roll and other Silent crossover styles helped non-Anglo cultural currents join the mainstream. Silent nonconformists began convening at coffee houses and uttering the occasional obscenity. In 1955, about the time when Allen Ginsberg read Howl at San Francisco's Six Gallery, a beat generation of goateed and sandaled young bohemians began sampling foreign cuisines, listening to offbeat jazz, reading hip poetry, telling sick jokes, and coyly deriding the G.I. Squaresville. G.I.s, like columnist Herb Kane, found these beatniks more amusing than threatening. Kennedy's election appeared to be a shining opportunity for the rising Silent and the reformist goals. As he brought a bright new cast of Silent helpmates, Pierre Salinger, Bill Moyers, Jacqueline Kennedy, into public prominence, he challenged the rest to enlist in the Peace Corps or join the civil rights movement. Millions did, nearly all of them men. Meanwhile, millions of Silent women glanced at the rings on their fingers, mops in their hands, and children at their feet, and began wondering about the whole arrangement. Premonitions of guilt began seeping into the Silent mindset, a dread that horrible social crimes were being committed and hushed up, all for the sake of social discipline. A civil rights movement led by the young Martin Luther King Jr. used nonviolence with increasing success to appeal to the GI conscience. As young outside agitators started to probe the GI edifice for weak points, this rising generation was singing, ever more loudly, "Deep in my heart, I do believe, we shall overcome someday." Finally, let's look at boomers entering childhood. Pediatrician Dr. Spock wanted to produce a new kind of child, and in many ways he did. "We need idealistic children," he announced in his Common Sense book of baby care, first published in 1946. Later, the phrase "Spock baby" would be applied to an entire generation of American high babies, born through an era in which his book sold more than 1 million copies annually. Through the American High, raising idealistic children became an anthem for GI parents who feared that their recent brush with apocalypse required a new temperament in the next generation. "We wanted our children to be inner-directed," recalled Ida Lashan. "It seemed logical to us that fascism and communism could not really succeed except in countries where children were raised by very authoritarian homes." Recalling their own youth collectivism, wincing at the McCarthy hearings, and worried about bland young adults, Lashan's GI peers wanted to raise children self-focused enough to resist peer pressure and isms of all kinds. Boomers were perceived as the modern kids of a modern age. Parents applied what Lashan termed democratic discipline, and dealt with children thoughtfully, reasonably, and kindly. Spock urged moms to coax rather than threaten in the nursery, and to apply a permissive or demand feeding schedule that let infants eat when they wanted, not according to fixed rules. While mom's task was to tend to every complaint, dad's was to pay the bills without the kids knowing where the money came from. Visiting Europeans joked about how strictly adult Americans obeyed their offspring. Thanks to greater affluence, declines in adult mortality, and so many stay-at-home mothers, boomer children enjoyed the most secure family life in American history. Meanwhile, the high standards of GI science bolstered public education. Boomers were taught by the brightest of GI women, to whom most other professions were closed. Spurred by the Soviet Sputnik launch, taxpayers seldom refused pleas to build and equip new schools. GI motives weren't just geopolitical. Many boomers recall parents telling them how hard adults were working to build a prosperous and secure country in which kids could grow up asking the big questions about the meaning of life, and maybe even coming up with some answers. Anything of interest to children keenly absorbed older people. Earlier in the 20th century, says Landon Jones, it would have been impossible to imagine the under 10 group starting anything. But the fads of the 50s, almost without exception, were the creations of children. From Mickey Mouse ears and Davy Crockett caps to hula hoops, Silly Putty, Slinky, and Barbie, boomers became the first child generation to be target marketed by advertising agencies. Toward the end of the high, teenagers became a very big deal in a nation that, in the recent crisis, had shown scant interest in silent adolescence. To boomer kids, any problem seemed fixable by competent and rational adults. To most middle-class youths, poverty, disease, and crime were invisible, or at worst, temporary nuisances that would soon succumb to the inexorable advance of affluence. At no other time in the 20th century did mainstream culture impart such a benign worldview to children. With life so free of danger, kids felt free to cultivate strong inner lives. Boomer kids were made to feel welcome, not just by their own parents, but also by their communities. They became the targets of libraries, recreation centers, and other civic entities that had, in the crisis, been the domain of working adults, or today of recreating seniors. Surrounded by such open-handed generosity, child boomers developed what Daniel Yankelevich termed the psychology of entitlement. Landon Jones recalls how what other generations have thought privileges, boomers thought were rights. Throughout the American high, the feed-on-demand boomer spirit remained sunny. This mood could not last indefinitely. True to its archetype, each generation could sustain its new role through that phase of life only. Approaching the next phase, no generation showed signs of accepting the role its predecessor had assumed at like age. Would GIs be cautious anchors, or the silent optimistic builders, or boomers acquiesce and helpmates? Would the next child generation enjoy an even warmer nurture? Nothing like that had ever happened before, nor would it happen this time. Toward the end of a high, strains begin to show. As each archetype enters its next phase of life, the hero into elderhood, the artist into midlife, the prophet into young adulthood, their prior social roles were becoming unsustainable. The post-war high was spent. It could not last. A new mood was necessary and coming. The spark came on November 22, 1963. From the standpoint of history, the events of that day were critical but not essential. Had Oswald missed, the specifics would have been different, but the saeculum would still have carved its path. The second turning would have come one way or another. It was time. Now let's examine the most recent second turning. That was the Consciousness Revolution, 1964 to 84. John Kennedy's assassination became a personal milestone for nearly everyone alive at the time. Immediately after that tragedy, Americans wanted to believe that nothing had been damaged. Theodore White surveyed a grieving Washington and declared it all as it had been before, unchanged. Yet even if America had not changed on the outside, an irreversible inner change had begun. A new wedge was penetrating the national psyche. The next year, 1964, brought the opening skirmishes of several new movements whose full meaning would reveal itself over the next two decades. That spring, Ed Sullivan invited the Beatles onto his show, implying elder approval for young people who banged drums and let their hair grow. That summer, the GOP convention that nominated Barry Goldwater set an angry new tone for politics, and inner cities unleashed the first of many long, hot summers. That fall, Berkeley's free speech movement raged against the academic establishment, and Democrats ran ads warning that Goldwater would incinerate flower-picking children. Meanwhile, LBJ had arranged a Tonkin Gulf incident that would soon enrage flower children of a different sort. A rupture appeared between the mood of the people and the mood of their leaders. On Capitol Hill, the nation's business went forward in an atmosphere of mutual understanding and respect, reported Advise and Consent novelist Alan Drury, while riots and violence flared in many places over the country. America had entered the awakening today remembered as the Consciousness Revolution. Following Kennedy's death, the U.S. economy roared along. With the business cycle harnessed, leaders bragged about growthmanship and gradually pushed down on the fiscal and monetary accelerator. Extrapolating from the last 20 years, top economists declared that Americans would soon have to spend their lives consuming rather than producing. Experts began wondering if people could handle such prosperity. Robert Theobald wrote of the challenge of abundance. Roy Herod of The Possibility of Economic Satiety, John Kenneth Galbraith of a technostructure that was programming the public into buying more stuff than anyone really needed or wanted. A hot issue was whether Americans were capable of making up their own minds and simply enjoying themselves. With the future promising such material abundance, the public began fixating on issues of conscience and dissent, prompting Alistair Cook to warn that a healthy rage against the pretensions and abuses of authority could lead to an amused distrust for any system or authority at all. Beneath it all lay a huge assumption. No matter how hard anyone raged, the physical infrastructure, power plants, highways, capital stock, and social habits, families, civic order, work habits, would remain rock solid. People came to believe that the more they got in touch with their inner desires, the more creatively they could consume what they produced, which would not only lend the cornucopia a higher purpose, but also keep it going. Although the awakening was made possible by this durable confidence in the American way of life, the era eroded first the confidence, then the way of life. During four midsummer weeks in 1969, three landmark events dramatized the most poignant contradictions of awakening-era America: Apollo 11, Woodstock, and Chappaquiddick. The first moon landing was a sublime expression of man's technological grandeur, marking the ultimate in mission control for those who believed in science, teamwork, and the conquest of nature. Yet, as the media reminded everyone, moon rockets also diverted resources from poor people. The capsule had barely returned when Woodstock coarsely challenged the social order that made it possible. Grandeur was passé. Bigness now meant half-clad mobs, not uniformed phalanxes. Meanwhile, Ted Kennedy's Chappaquiddick misadventure exemplified America's declining standards of public duty and private virtue, and their flight from the suffocating duties of family life and child-raising. In between watching these news stories on TV, people went to the bookstore to buy Portnoy's Complaint, to the theater to see O Calcutta, and to the movies to watch Rosemary's Baby. Jimi Hendrix's siren song, Star-Spangled Banner, marked America's cultural Rubicon. Nothing in the culture would ever again feel quite the same, or later, feel quite so spontaneous and new. That same year, 1969, was the bloodiest of the Vietnam War, the conflict that lay at the awakening's epicenter. Perhaps Vietnam's civil war would have been a fixable foreign problem back in the high, but American intervention was doomed to failure in the awakening. Scientifically managed, the war tried to prop up a morally questionable ally without slowing the pace of grand constructions at home. It didn't work. For the first time in living memory, America's leaders were forced to concede that big national problems both abroad and at home lay beyond their capacity to solve. Yet the Vietnam War was more symptom than cause of the deepening cultural upheaval. The nation's domestic planners voiced the same hubris that afflicted the Pentagon. In 1966, LBJ's poverty chief, Sergeant Shriver, predicted that the war on poverty would be won in about 10 years. By the early 1970s, even as the Vietnam War effort sputtered, the goal of guns and butter, plus a guaranteed income, was considered achievable for a nation then landing men on the moon twice a year. After Saigon fell, both political parties agreed to spend the new peace dividend on middle-class elder benefits. Nixon, Wilbur Mills, George McGovern, and other GI leaders realized that while the future cost of these benefits were vast, they were nonetheless affordable because younger generations would someday be richer than Croesus. What they didn't realize was that the high-era cornucopia was already a broken-down machine running on fumes. Many Americans stopped believing in, or even caring about, economic progress. As people started looking at the future more inwardly, opinion leaders began to question whether further abundance would make Americans better people or simply corrupt them with greed. From the first Earth Day in April 1970 to the last Apollo launch in December 1972, cutting-edge America made the break from a think big to a small is beautiful mindset. Then, in 1973-74, the institutional order and prosperity broke down. With Watergate and its coincident recession, the forces of individualism had triumphed.